everybody. Good morning. So, Leo Hansen, thank you very much. Thank you. That was Leo Hansen on the flute. For those of you who don't know, on the shakuhachi. Thank you. I'll start by introducing myself, just because I'm not here very often on Sundays. And a lot of you who are regulars don't have a clue who I am. But I've actually been here at the Zen Center for about 8 years. I'm here through the week. I'm here a lot. I'm just not usually here on weekends because I live in the Brainerd Lakes area. So I come here through the week. I was ordained about 2.5 years ago, and I was ordained with Martin, Chris, and Ben, who are all here today. So, this morning I'm going to talk about the three poisons. The three poisons in Buddhism are greed, anger, and delusion. The Sanskrit word is kleshas, which actually sounds kind of friendly, huh? In Buddhist psychology, they're called mental afflictions, which doesn't sound friendly at all. So mental afflictions are the kleshas. There's a lot of them, but greed, anger, and delusion most directly affect our ability to just be present. And according to Buddhist psychology, all the others arise from these three. So, we know how closely we identify with our thoughts. We all know that. It's our experience. So, if we are identifying with thoughts rooted in greed, anger, and delusion, and Buddhist psychology tells us we are, yikes. because what we identify with becomes our experience. So I'll start with just a definition, the way they're defined in Buddhism, because we define them very broadly. When we say greed, we're defining it to include selfishness, misplaced desire, attachment, grasping for happiness and satisfaction outside ourselves. So that's all of those would be included whenever we say greed. It covers all of them. So the broad definition for anger is aversion toward unpleasant people, unpleasant circumstances, and even toward our own thoughts and feelings. Perhaps mostly toward our own thoughts and feelings. And delusion includes cognitive dullness, confusion, misperception, and intellectual laziness. Yeah. That's what I thought. So the kleshas directly affect our ability to just be present. So they affect our ability to experience life in a vivid way and with immediacy. Instead, life often feels murky and confusing. But here's what life could be. I'm going to start with this. This is what it could be for us. I'm going to read a poem by Layman Pang, who lived in the 8th century. He was an 8th century Zen poet. He lived in China. This is what his experience of life is like. My daily affairs are quite ordinary, but I'm in total harmony with them. I don't hold on to anything, don't reject anything. Nowhere an obstacle or conflict. Who cares about wealth and honor? Even the poorest thing shines. My miraculous power and spiritual activity, chopping wood and carrying water. My miraculous power and spiritual activity, chopping wood and carrying water. So what miraculous power is Layman Pang talking about here? What does he have? He disappears. He knows how to disappear. That's pretty miraculous, don't you think? He just disappears in his activity, whatever it is. Chopping wood and carrying water represents whatever activity we do. And in Zen, just disappearing. That's our practice, just disappearing, being one with the activity. And Layman Pang is able to do that. He's able to do that after years of meditation practice. So that's the simplicity and clarity and the vividness of just being. The poem itself is beautiful, but what it points to is even more beautiful. So why is it so hard to just be with our activity? Why is it so hard to experience the clarity and vividness that's expressed in this poem? Because Zen tells us that this vividness and this clarity is how the world really is. The world as it is what we say in Zen. The world as it is. And Zen tells us that is the way the world really is. But it's not our experience. For most of us, it's not our experience. For most of us, we get glimpses, and they're great, but fleeting. And most of the time what I experience is just my own spinning mind. And ego tells me that my spinning mind is doing something really important. Solving problems, making the world a better place. Buddhist psychology tells me it's just habit energy run amok. Habit energy. So Buddhist teachings say we don't experience clarity and vividness because of the three poisons, because of thoughts of anger, greed, and delusion. And the three poisons belong to ego. So when we're identifying with the three poisons, we're identifying with ego, and ego can't touch the present moment. And the present is the only place. It's the only place that we can experience the world as it is. So that's why all the fuss. That's why we talk so much about the three poisons in Buddhism. So I'm going to talk about three ways that we work with the kleshas in Buddhism. And then I'll give an example of them in a story. So the three practices are meditation, the three that I'm going to talk about, meditation, antidotes, and vow. So meditation, antidotes, and vow. In Zen, it's always meditation first and foremost. First and foremost. That's what we do. Because with meditation, with a steady, regular practice, you know, the mind just slows down naturally. Just slows down. And very often, that's all we need. So much of it just kind of drops away once we see it. So when the mind is not spinning like a top, and when it slows down, then understanding just arises naturally. It's just what happens. And when understanding arises, it's like seeing a sunset. Actually, it's more like seeing a sunrise. But they're both the same. Because when something new arises in our consciousness and some of the murkiness just drops away, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it happens with a regular meditation practice. It happens. We see that we are not our thoughts. And that's a big aha moment. We see that we're not our thoughts. And then our behavior just changes naturally and organically. But sometimes we do need to do more because the kleshas can be very sticky. So for the sticky ones in meditation, when they arise in meditation, we just be there with them. You know, we just be there with them without judging. Feel the anger without getting caught up in it. That's what we do. And when your mind starts to slow down, you start to see how that's actually done. you know, it sounds kind of confusing before you start a meditation practice to hear somebody talk about it. But when you can see it, you just see it. You just see it. And what you see is that you can look at the thought, and you can look at just the thought rather than the content of the thought. You know, we're so caught up in the content of the thought. We get mesmerized by the content of the thought that we don't realize that we can just look at the angry thought and see it as just that. It's just anger. And we don't have to engage in it. And that's our practice. That's what we do. Of course, you know, that's our practice when we're practicing. When we're not, you know, when anger arises, the first thing we do is we look for a target. And that's full engagement. Okay. But every time I see one of those really sticky kleshas, and I see it really clearly, and I can see it all the way through, then I'm a little further along on the path. And that's pretty cool, too. So the other tool I want to talk about for transforming the kleshas is antidotes. We also use antidotes. But it's not an either-or proposition, you guys. Because if you're not meditating, probably any of these tools that Buddhism can offer is not going to work for you. Because in all of them, the first thing you have to do is observe. You have to be able to see what's going on in your mind. And to do that, you have to slow it down. So again, working with antidotes, you start with observation. You see the klesha, the feeling, the anger, whatever it is, come up. And if you can't just let it go, you can replace it with an antidote. You can replace the negative thought with a positive one. So the antidotes for greed are thoughts of selflessness, generosity, detachment, and contentment. We can replace thoughts of desire with thoughts of generosity. We can think about what we have to contribute rather than what we want to get. Not brain science, is it? So for anger, the antidotes are thoughts of loving kindness, of compassion, of patience and forgiveness. When we're angry with someone, we can stop the thought stream. If we want to, we can stop it and look for something to appreciate in that person. There's always something. But if we're too angry and we just can't go there, then we can still stop the angry thought stream by thinking about someone we love, someone we do care about, our child, our spouse, our parents. And when you do that, what's really helpful is to feel what a difference it makes in your body. Immediate. It's immediate. Just stopping that angry thought stream and replacing it with something, the other extreme, you can feel it in your body right away. And then you really experience what the anger is doing to you. So the antidote for delusion, we contemplate on the teachings, on the nature of reality. We can contemplate on the impermanent nature of things, on interconnectedness. And even the kleshas are interconnected. So to work on one is to work on all of them. So if it works best for you just to focus on one, then cool. So now I'm going to tell a story that illustrates how this transformation works. The story I'm going to tell is in a book. Excuse me. It's in the book The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell. He tells the story. It's from the Vedas. And the Vedas are the record of Hindu religion. So So this is a story that Buddha would have grown up with. And this is a story about Indra. He is the god of storm. And in the early Vedas, anyway, he was the most popular of the gods. There are about 250 hymns about Indra in the Vedas, which is many, many times more than anybody else, any of the other gods. He was very mischievous, was always getting into trouble, and he was always being punished, which explains his popularity, right? So I'm just going to read the story first and then go back and talk about it. But there are three characters in the story. Three characters. There's Indra, there's a carpenter, and there's a mysterious boy. So think about these characters as different aspects of personality, of everybody's personality. That's what they represent, okay? So the story is about the three poisons. I've tweaked it to illustrate the three poisons. And it's about working with antidotes. It's about stopping the negative thought stream and replacing it with a positive one. So look for this interaction as I tell the story, okay? Joseph Campbell titles this story, Indra and the Parade of Ants. Oh, why not? But I should say that this is not Joseph Campbell's interpretation of the myth. This is my interpretation. So if you've read the book, this is not going to sound familiar. Here's the story. When Indra was born, the world was a wasteland because a great serpent dragon had enclosed all the waters of the earth, and so there was a great drought. Now, Indra, being the god of storm and thunder, dropped a thunderbolt on the dragon and forced him to release the water. So having defeated the serpent dragon, he was elevated to the rank of king of the gods. So Indra, now king of the gods, says something to the effect of, "Wow, how great am I?" And so he does what all god kings do. He hired a carpenter and set out building a grand castle. So the carpenter goes to work on it, and he's building it exactly as Indra ordered it. Maybe even better. And Indra comes to inspect it, and it's wonderful. It's magnificent. He's so happy as he walks through and he looks at it. It's great. Well, could be a little bit bigger. So he goes to the carpenter and he orders it up a little bit bigger. So the carpenter goes to work on it, making it bigger. And a while later, Indra comes to, check it out. And he's walking around and he's just thrilled. I mean, it's even better than he ordered. Couldn't be happier. If it were a little bigger, he could have been a little happier. So he goes to the carpenter and he, orders it up a little bigger. And he is the king of the gods, so, what does the carpenter do? So this goes on for quite some time. Actually, it goes on until finally, to the carpenter's great relief, a boy shows up in the kingdom. A boy just shows up. Now, this boy is described as being very beautiful. He is blue-black in color. And he has a voice that sounds like rolling thunder. So this is a very mysterious being. So when Indra hears about the boy, he invites him into the castle. His temporary castle, while he's waiting for the big one. And he asks all the usual questions, who are you? Where are you from? And the boy says, "I heard that there was an Indra building a castle that's bigger and better than any other Indra has ever accomplished. So I wanted to come see it." So Indra chuckles at this, the silly boy thinking that there had ever been another Indra. And he doesn't believe any of it, but he's curious about this mystery that's standing in front of him. "So where do you come from?" Indra asks. And the boy starts telling him about all the places throughout space and time that he's been. And he talks about the interconnectedness of all things. And he talks about impermanence. And this is not what Indra wants to hear. He's starting to get worried. He's starting to feel a little uneasy. Actually, he's starting to squirm a little in his throne. We all know how that feels, right? And then suddenly, the boy looks down at the floor and bursts out laughing. And Indra demands, you know, what are you laughing about? Because he's kind of agitated by now. And pointing to the long line of ants, the boy says, all of them, former Indras all. And he says, they rose from the lowest conditions to the highest illumination. Then they dropped their thunderbolt on a dragon and thought, how great am I? And down they went. So Indra calls for the carpenter and tells him to stop all the building. The palace is too big already. So now that's the story. I'm just going to talk about it. So when Indra was born, he saw the terrible condition of the world. And he just wanted to help. You know, he was filled with a wholehearted ambition to free the world from the dragon and restore harmony. He just wanted to help. He knew how to be a god, and he was good at it. And when he defeated the dragon, there was no thought of I. He was just chopping wood and carrying water. But when you're the god of storm, you're slinging thunderbolts and killing dragons, you know. But it's all the same. So Joseph Campbell said that when he crosses a threshold in his life, he knows how to navigate it. Because he's prepared, because myths have told him how to navigate it. They've shown him the way. So Indra knew how to be a god, and he was good at it. He didn't know how to be the king of the gods. So when he crossed that threshold, he was lost. All he knew about god kings was that they lived in huge castles. So that's what he started doing. That's what he started doing. He started building a big castle. Now, when I first started working with this myth, several months ago, I thought it was just a cautionary tale about pride and arrogance. And that's how I worked with it for a long time, pride and arrogance. That's all I saw because I was judging Indra. And I was judging him in exactly the same way that I judge myself. But when I stopped sticking my opinion into it and started just really looking at it, I started seeing it in a whole different way. Then the myth became a deep teaching about crossing thresholds. Indra crossed a threshold and he was lost. And it happens to all of us. When we cross a threshold, it can be positive or negative. You know, we could lose a job or we could get a promotion. We could, birth of a child or the loss of a spouse or a parent or someone we love. It doesn't matter what it is. When we cross a threshold, when we go into new territory, we're lost. And we're vulnerable. And ego is an opportunist. But even in times of transition, if we can slow our minds down enough, then we can get some clarity. And we won't get trapped the way Indra did. But during a crisis or any kind of transition, you know, when it's harder than ever to sustain a regular meditation practice, that's when we need it the most. But if we don't have a regular meditation practice going into a crisis, we probably won't be able to do that. So Indra was thrown off balance by this change. And it doesn't take much, you guys. Just a mere thought. Just a whisper of how great am I? Or even how great I want to be? Or even I? And ego steps forward. Remember that Indra recognized ego when it arose as a serpent dragon, all filled with desire and bullying people around. He recognized it and he defeated it. But when ego arose in the form of a beautiful palace, Indra didn't recognize it. So that tells us two things, two important things about life and about ego. First, life is a progression. So the tools that we used yesterday, that worked for us yesterday, they're not going to work for us today. If we try and rely on them, we're going to be lost. And it also warns us that ego transforms itself all the time. And it's always a challenge because ego has so many different disguises. So when ego arose as a beautiful palace, Indra thought it was his ally. And it kept getting bigger and bigger. He was seduced by desire and blinded by aversion. Sounds a little bit familiar. Come on, you guys. It sounds a little bit familiar. They're so intertwined. When one arises, the other two are always very close by. So aversion, I say aversion, because Indra didn't want to face the inadequacy that he was feeling. He didn't want to face that. And any time you refuse to accept reality, then what you experience instead is not reality. It's something else. Usually something really cool, actually. Something the ego has cooked up. But it's not reality. Cool, but not reality. So, the introduction of the boy is a very important moment because this mysterious being represents insight, represents wisdom. And we don't always recognize insight when it arises. Intuition can be a mystery to us. So at first, Indra resists what the boy is telling him. He resists the insight that is emerging because building a glorious castle is seductive. Made him feel important. So he didn't want to hear what the boy was telling him, but he didn't call the guards and have the boy hauled away. Why? Why didn't he do that? Why did he just listen to this boy who was telling him things he didn't want to hear? Why did he listen? Remember what the voice sounds like? Rolling thunder. Not because it's loud, you guys. The voice was not loud. But Indra is the king of storm. So this voice, he may not recognize the messenger. He didn't recognize the boy. But this voice was a voice from home that he recognized. So he listened. He was drawn to the voice. He couldn't have the boy called out because he was drawn to the voice. And this part of the story, the dance between the boy and Indra, is about using antidotes. This is where Indra is starting to replace thoughts of delusion with thoughts of the true nature of the universe. Finally, he's interrupting the flow of negative delusive thoughts. But interventions are not easy. We always resist them. But to Indra's credit, he listened. He just kept listening. And this is deep listening, you guys. This is deep listening because the voice from home is always very soft. Insight never imposes itself on us. And this part of the story is beautiful because a mysterious something has arisen in Indra's awareness. And Indra's trying to figure it out. He's trying to see it. You've heard the saying that meditation is an adventure. Well, this is it. This is the adventure, and it's true. The boy represents an awakening. Indra is waking up to something new. So here's what the poet Rainer Maria Rilke said about waking up to something new. There are moments when something new has entered us, something unknown. Our feelings grow mute in shy perplexity. Everything in us withdraws. A stillness comes, and the new, which no one knows, stands in the midst of it. I'm going to read that again. For there are moments when something new has entered us, something unknown. Our feelings grow mute with shy perplexity. Everything in us withdraws. A stillness comes, and the new, which no one knows, stands in the midst of it. So the mysterious boy is not telling Indra anything that he wants to hear. But Indra doesn't send him away because what the boy is saying rings true. Rings true. To the god of storm, nothing rings more true than the sound of rolling thunder. How could it? It's his true nature. So the next part of the story, when the boy points to the parade of ants, this is the climax right here. This is the takeaway. So this parade of ants streaming across the floor is Indra's streaming thoughts of self-importance, graphically illustrated as a parade of ants. You can't get a better visual than that. So by using the antidotes and by deep listening, Indra is able to stop all the castle building and to move on, to cross the threshold and into his new role as God King. And he does that. He finally crosses the threshold. And he goes on to be a very effective God King, doing lots of great and terrible things, as we all do, right? Great and terrible things. So this was one of the many myths that Siddhartha grew up with, and he would have been influenced by this myth. We're always influenced by our cultural myths because they speak directly to our unconscious. They bypass our critical thinking, much like koans. So they work much like koans. And we use koans a lot in here. We don't use myths. We should use myths a little more. So if you Google this myth about Indra and the ants, it won't be the story I just told. This is the way the myth spoke to me at this stage in my life after months of working with it. And if you were to work with this myth and give it new life, it would be another story still. It would be totally different. So the third way that we work with kleshas in Buddhism is the practice of vow. We recite vows over and over here at the Zen Center. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to extinguish them. If they were not inexhaustible, we wouldn't need a vow. So we'll be reciting this vow in just a few minutes. That is the one we recite on Sundays, isn't it, Dawn? Okay, good. But before we do, I want to end with a poem by Han Shan. He was a 9th century Chinese poet, also known as Coal Mountain. And this poem is about moving beyond the glaciers, or at least that's what it's about for me. Okay, here it is. Clambering up the Coal Mountain path, the Coal Mountain trail goes on and on. The long gorge choked with scree and boulders, the wide creek, the mist, blurred grass. The moss is slippery, though there's been no rain. The pine sings, but there's no wind. Who can leap the world's ties and sit with me among the white clouds? I'm going to try that again and see if I can be a little more smooth so you guys can get the gist of it, okay? Here it is again. Clambering up the Coal Mountain path, the Coal Mountain trail goes on and on. The long gorge choked with scree and boulders, the wide path, the mist-blurred grass. The moss is slippery, though there's been no rain. The pine sings, but there's no wind. Who can leap the world's ties and sit with me among the white clouds? So that was a poem about moving beyond the glaciers. And that's all I have to say today. Thank you, guys. Is there any questions or comments? Anything anybody would like to say or ask?
And maybe it's because you refer to the psychology of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And this might just be that I've been misinformed, but I thought I had learned that anger is really not a true emotion, that it is an emotion that is a hidden for something else that the mind hasn't recognized.
Are you saying maybe behind the anger there's usually something else, sadness or... Yeah, and that's what we see when we look at it. That's what we see. You know, a lot of times in meditation, if you're angry, you can just look at the anger, and if it's not, you know, if it's not really huge, it just kind of drops away and you're free of it, and you can just let it go. You don't have to analyze it anymore. But sometimes it can be deeper than that, and if we can just stay with it and just feel it in our body, and just look at it without being engaged by it, without being carried away by it, without looking at the content of it, just feeling it directly, then often when we start to move through, that's exactly what we see. We move through anger. And we feel the anger, and then suddenly the feeling in our body starts to change, starts to take a different flavor, and we realize that what we're feeling now is sadness. And we don't have to stop and try and analyze that sadness and try and figure out where it came from. We don't have to do that. We just have to feel it. When you stop and analyze it, you're interrupting the process. And I know that's what they say you have to do in psychology. That's not what we do in Zen. Because if you just stop and feel it, a lot of times it just kind of drops away. And there's nothing there to analyze. So if there's nothing there to analyze, why, you know, dig up stuff, you know? And sometimes you'll move through the sadness and you'll see something else there. There's something else. And you just feel that. And if you just keep working with this in this way, you know, usually these feelings, they just need to be expressed. They just need to be acknowledged. They don't want to be dug into, you know. But this is just my experience, you guys. It's all I can share with you is my experience. That's how I worked through them. Thank you. Thank you for your question. Anyone else?
How do you deal with ego when you are surrounded by people in a field where ego is the main reason for existence?
Well, you know, that's life in America.
Right.
Really.
Right.
I guess you just remember that you don't have to deal with their ego. You know, you just have to deal with your own. You know, it's hard not to be reactionary, you know, when you're being faced with everybody else's ego. But you can't go around telling everybody, you know, that's your ego. You know, look through it, man. You know. So you just have to. I don't know. We do it every day. Yeah. You know how you do it? You spend a lot of time on the cushion. That's how you, because it just slows down your mind enough that if your mind is slow enough, when you feel yourself starting to engage in their ego, be entangled in their ego, if you can slow down your mind enough to see that as it's happening, then you can pull back, and then their ego is not your problem. Their ego only becomes your problem when you get entangled in their ego. But it happens just like that. Yeah. But during if you sustain a meditation practice, it will slow down, and you can actually, it's almost like, you know, slow motion at a movie, you know, you can just see yourself reaching out. You know? You can stop, pull it back. You really can.
I'm wondering about the comment you made that if delusions were not inexhaustible or infinite, that we wouldn't be involved. And that seems...
Oh, you're so cute, Martin.
Thank you. Delusion number one. But that seems counterintuitive.
Yes, it does, doesn't it, Martin?
I just would love to hear more about your, kind of your take on that.
Well, it seems to kind of say it all just to say if they weren't inexhaustible, we wouldn't need a vow. It's the inexhaustibility of it that just keeps us in this place that we're constantly aware of them. I mean, we're constantly coming up against them. And so, you know, we're constantly living the vow. Because a vow is not something you just say. A vow is something you live. And if you're not constantly coming up against this inexhaustibility, then the vow dies. Because if you're not living it, it dies. Is that okay, Marty?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Anyone else? Thanks, you guys.
Well, that was a great first.
Thank you.